Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Going back to late 2014 to late 2015, there was a dramatic change in the cattle market, right? And so as you've seen, record profits or near record profits end of 2014 to very large losses in 2015, you know, that highlights the need for risk management. And
Iowa State livestock economist Lee Schultz.
As you look at feeder cattle prices, they're some of the highest prices we've ever seen. There's a lot of money at stake. So I think it's important to keep in mind the factors that you can control. And that's price risk management. There's a lot of tools available that allow you to at least have some insurance or put a floor on some of these prices. I think you want to keep the upside open potentially as you look at, you know, possible strength in prices, but also mitigate what could be potentially lower prices here, at least seasonally as we go through the next couple of months.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I was just conversing with my colleague, Senator Graham, about our experience on the Gang of Eight. Was that about 10 years ago?
Dick Durbin from Illinois is chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee at a recent hearing focused on farm labor.
We had four Democrats and four Republicans, and we spent months putting together a comprehensive immigration reform bill, which passed in the floor of the Senate. Included in that farm bill was a section on farm workers agreed to by both growers and farm workers, and it involved the path to citizenship. It was, I think, a thoughtful and serious attempt to address this problem. It passed in the Senate, was never called for consideration in the House of Representatives. Senator Bennett has been one of the leaders on this issue from Colorado, Senator Feinstein, Senator Rubio, and a few others. I do believe there is a will to solve this problem. And the fact that it's part of comprehensive immigration reform is a fact that we have, we think, valid arguments in many aspects of immigration to consider it. And I hope we do. I ultimately hope we do. I want to say that I have no prejudice against growers and farmers at all. I've had a valued member of my staff for many years who was one of the, whose family was one of the largest employers of migrant farm workers in Illinois, in southern Illinois. Good people, really thoughtful people who cared a lot for their workers, and they showed it. I also want to say that we're living in a world that is hard to understand. I pass by these fast food restaurants, and I see what's written on the signs outside. Burger King, $15.70 an hour to start at your Burger King. You go by on I-55 driving from Chicago to Springfield, you pass an Aldi warehouse, Aldi, of course, being a major grocery company. They're offering nearly $20 an hour for starting salaries. For people who come to work for Aldi, I don't know what they'd be doing, but it certainly would not start off as being too technical. And they're being offered $20 an hour to sign up. So when we talk about the current wage rate in this country, I think we have to be honest and realistic about it. There's a competition going on and a bidding war for our limited number of workers.
Durbin questioning Diana Telefsentoris, CEO of the United Farm Workers.
Just a few weeks ago, it was disclosed about the exploitation of child labor, immigrant child labor. And that some of that's happening in the heart of the Midwest. You know, I'm not going to name names for the states that are involved. But we think that we're above that sort of thing, and it's not true. In food processing and slaughterhouses, children are being employed. I don't know if it's intentionally but or negligently, but it doesn't speak well for our country that that would be happening. You mentioned one of the young people with you today who started picking fruit at age 14, did you say?
Correct.
Is that common?
That is common. Unfortunately, in agriculture, children can work in ag at a very young age. And so, you know, oftentimes you have parents, we're talking about poverty wages here, where farm workers are making between like median and mean, somewhere between $17,500 a year to a little less than $20,000 a year.
Chalmers Carr is CEO of Titan Farms in South Carolina.
First of all, Ms. Torres was referring to non-H-2A workers, and unfortunately, she was also referring to undocumented workers. This is one of the reasons why I joined the H-2A program 25 years ago. I have the oversight of the Department of Labor investigating or coming and looking at me every time. My payroll and my payroll records are published. They come in and look at those. Every employee on my farm gets a separate paycheck with their wage statement. So participating in the H-2A program is one way we can make sure that there isn't farm labor abuse.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
That's a really good question, and I think the lawyers are still trying to figure that out.
Supreme Court ruling against the Environmental Protection Agency in waters of the U.S. and the rule set forth in the Obama administration. Now, Darren Kopic is president and CEO of the Ag Retailers Association and says with EPA recently announcing a new rule before the court's decision has us scratching our heads.
One of the key things in the decision is that the court, while the actual test that they put in place to determine whether something is a WOTUS or not, that was not a united opinion. It's a 5-4 opinion. But all of them, all nine justices agreed that the way it was being done under the Obama rule and then the Biden rule as it was reestablished is not consistent with the statute. And so they unanimously ruled in favor of the property owners, the Sacketts from Idaho, who had just been trying to develop their property. So as far as the rules and what's in place now, the court did not vacate the Biden rule, but it basically said that this rule won't hold up to judicial scrutiny. And so even though it's still in place, it's pretty much gutted. We commented at the time that EPA put this rule out, and I think it was January, that look, you know, there's a court case pending before the Supreme Court that deals directly with regulation of waters of the United States. Why in the world would you want to put out a rule when you know the Supreme Court's going to rule on it and then make you go back and do that work all over again? But they went ahead and did it, and unfortunately our prediction proved true. Now EPA has to figure out how they're going to change that rule to make it consistent with the law and with the ruling of the court.
Almost immediately, some members of Congress and proponents of that rule were saying farmers would start polluting wetlands. But Kopic says,
well, I think that where I would start is that the lands that these farmers are managing belong to them. What possible incentive would they have to pollute those lands or the wetlands that are on them and adjacent to them when their goal is to hand those properties down to the next generation and continue farming? That was something that we faced on the farm where I grew up, is people would accuse us indirectly of wanting to poison the land and abuse the resources that we had. And it was like, look, we own this stuff. We paid for it. We have a high motivation to take care of it. And that's true of the farmers across the country, too. So that's where I'd start. But there are a lot of conservation programs that people can be involved in, whether it's through NRCS or through cover crop incentive programs, or even things that some of our retail members are doing in the carbon space. There are lots of ways that people can show what they're doing to take care of the environment. We've also been kind of tangentially involved in an Aim for Climate effort that came out of the UN Food Systems Summit from a guy, I guess a little over a year ago. And the point of that program is to demonstrate on a global stage, these are the kinds of things agriculture can do to make sure we have sustainable, productive, resilient food systems. And so I think all of those things together, with people just reaching out in their communities and making themselves available to talk to people, building that common level of trust, a common frame of reference, those are the kinds of ways that we'll be able to make some traction here and hopefully push back against some of the social media and uninformed opinions that are shooting at us at the moment.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The 2023 wheat harvest started this last Tuesday, and the wheat's coming in looking relatively good. One elevator manager says, boy, those are beautiful kernels of wheat.
Dr. Kim Anderson, Oklahoma State Extension Grain Marketing Economist.
There's three problems with this harvest. One, production is well below average. Two, wheat prices have fallen off about $1.25 over the last week. And three, the farmers are selling this limited amount of wheat into a volatile market. You can go back to the first year you can forward contract wheat from anywhere $7.50 to $8. By February the 21st, it peaked out at $8.30. By March the 9th, it had fallen to $7.20. In 37 trading days, April the 17th, it was back up to $8.30. Then by May the 2nd, it fell to $6.95. back up to $8.55, and now it's down around $7.25. This is a volatile market to sell into. You look at the variability in it, go back to February. We lost $1.10 in 12 trading days, in 12 market days. Now, it took 37 trading days to get that $1.10 back. Then in 11 trading days, we took $1.35 off of it. In 10 trading days, about 2 weeks, added $1.60 back to that price. And then in 10 trading days, we got back down to $7.25 where we are now. So the question is, how do you sell your wheat, your limited amount of wheat, into this market? And in my opinion, you need to stagger it in the market, sell it over time. The problem is selling into this volatile market, selling your limited amount of wheat in this volatile market. My suggestion is pick a date where you want to have all your wheat sold, and then set specific dates you want to sell a certain percent of it in that time. In other words, dollar cost averaging, because when you've got a 10 to 20 to 30 cent price move in a given day, selling on Monday rather than Tuesday can make a big difference. My recommendation is make your sales mechanical. Set dates and pull the trigger on those dates, irrespective of what happens.
Follow Dr. Anderson online, sunup.okstate.edu. Dan O'Brien's a Kansas State grain marketing economist.
With the recent range, it's always a fair question. Well, are we in a situation at all where we'll get delayed and start to get closer to crop insurance planting deadlines? And I think for, of course, the big issue, the first crop that we've been out on is corn. As we mentioned before, we're 71% planted as of May 21st. We've been raining in some locations. We still have time to get varieties in, but the window is getting a little bit tighter. People may have waited on their non-irrigated crops in the western part of the state, and they've been getting rain since then, so we'll be watching that. The next option would be to go with sorghum, and again, we're normally, in the last 5 years, we've been about 9% planted at this state, and now they're 12. So we have sorghum as an option if the rainfall forces us at the back end of the crop insurance window here eventually for corn. We'll see what happens. And for soybeans in Kansas, we're normally about 52% planted. And over the last 5 years, here as of May 21st anyway, we were 54% planted. So again, I don't think anybody probably in the state is running into, I would hope most people probably are not yet extremely worried about getting crops in because things have been too wet. However, we have been getting some rain now. We'll see where that takes us. And I don't think anybody's going to worry too much until we get to June 1 and start to see crop insurance deadlines approach.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
All right, America. Half the people in the food supply chain, vegetables and peaches and all that other stuff we like to eat, are here illegally.
Lindsey Graham from South Carolina is the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
If they all left tomorrow, what would happen to the agricultural community, Mr. Carr?
I would ask you, what would happen to our country? Because our food supply would go down and our food security would absolutely disappear overnight.
What do you think, Mr. Lynch?
I would agree. I think that a lot of those jobs are likely being filled now by
right.
people.
What do you think, Mr. Sikora?
Yeah, I would agree with the All other right. comments, certainly.
Here's the deal. Half the people working here legally, if they left tomorrow, would be hosed. So how do you fix it? You find a way to keep them here on our terms without making other problems worse. Does everybody agree that's kind of a reasonable solution? They stay here, but they have to pay taxes. They have to earn their way into some kind of legal relationship with the United States. Does that make sense to everybody on this panel? Okay. Good. Now, here's the problem. If we do agriculture alone, and I know Chalmers doesn't like hearing this, you're going to have to include other parts of the economy that have the same problem you do. Because there are a lot of people out there who want more labor like you do. And there are a lot of people on my side, less now, thinking this is not a problem at all. It's a problem. If you say there's enough American workers to make agriculture work in America, you don't know what you're talking about. And if you say that that we can survive in this country as farmers, given foreign competition, you don't know what you're talking about. We're going to import more food than we export because it's so much cheaper to farm in other places than it is here. So the goal we've been trying to achieve all these years, Mr. Chairman, is to fix this problem in a way that's a win-win. Is there any asylum reform in the bill that we're talking about regarding agricultural workers? The answer is no. So if we did this bill tomorrow and you didn't change the asylum system, you're going nowhere with illegal immigration. That's the problem. A secure border is necessary, I think, as part of any effort to provide legalization to people already here that are adding value to our country. Most Americans want to secure the border, and Democratic colleagues have been in the past very good on this. So I don't want to sugarcoat this. Everything you say is true. Ms. Torres, everything you say, I don't doubt one bit what you say is true about particularly women, how they're being treated. Mr. Lynch, Mr. Carr, I don't doubt one bit if these rules keep going into effect, we're going to put you out of business. And Leon, you've been trying to fix this for years. Mr. Costa, we may have a different view about the impact of raising wages to $23 an hour across the board on the American consumer. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for having the hearing. The only solution available to us is to take the problem in agriculture, come up with a win-win for the agricultural community, but also deal with the other magnets of illegal immigration and help other parts of the economy that are experiencing the same thing you're experiencing. So I'll end where I began. I'm for small deals. I'm for medium deals. I'm for big deals. But we're living in a world of no deals. To the American people, we got a lot of problems. But what this hearing tells me, if we don't reform our agricultural system, food prices are going to spike in this country. It's going to become a national security problem. And a lot of American farmers are going to be out of business because they can't compete with foreign entities that don't have to deal with these problems.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
This is a huge issue for ag, and it's one that we've been, as a group, wrestling with and trying to work on for a number of years.
Darren Kopic is CEO of the Ag Retailers Association on Waters of the U.S.
I'll give out a shout-out to the American Farm Bureau Federation. They've been carrying the most of the water. Sorry about the pun. But they've been really, really involved in this, kind of the conductor of the choir, if you will. A lot of us have been involved in it, and it's huge because it changes the way that the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA define what water is subject to Clean Water Act permitting. And that's important for us because any application of products like pesticides or fertilizers to a water of the United States requires a Clean Water Act discharge permit, a whole separate layer of permitting than what we face today. And so the more clearly we can define what these waters are and make it so that a farmer can step out in their field and know without having to hire an engineer or a consultant, is this a water of the United States or not? This is a huge step forward for the whole industry.
From Waters of the U.S. to the debt, where House Majority Leader Steve Scalise recently said it's a big win for ag and business because it puts the government on a shot clock when it comes to regulations.
I don't know whether his shot clock vision is going to come true or not, but I like the concept. And there are some, even in the PREA legislation, which wasn't part of this one, but the Pesticide Registration Improvement Act legislation that passed in December, put some timelines and some accountability on EPA's approval process for pesticides. And that I think is going to be helpful in at least communicating the status of where products are in that chain. And so concept can translate into other things that the government's doing, that's got to be good. The thing that I think might complicate that is that in order for the government to be able to meet its timelines, there needs to be some kind of a restraint put on citizen lawsuits. And I'm not trying to say that there shouldn't be a citizen suit avenue available for cases that justify it. But so many of the activist groups use citizen suits that sue EPA or sue other agencies all the time. And what that ends up doing is creating a backlog for agency work, things that they're supposed to be doing, they can't do because they're responding to litigation and court-imposed deadlines. And so that whole situation is creating an immense workload at EPA and elsewhere that needs to be addressed if the government's going to be able to hit timelines reliably.
So what could be coming down the road for the industry?
The interesting development that's going on now is the expansion of biological products in the agriculture space. Whether that is just from innovation and trying to make more efficient use of nutrients or substitute products in, or whether it's a result of losing crop protection products like we've done with chlorpyrifos and some other ones that are kind of in the gate. People are looking at biologicals as an alternative to those if we lose the conventional products or get those restricted to the point that you have to have some extra help. So I think that's a booming area. There's a lot of interest, a lot of development, a lot of companies involved in it. And one of the key roles that our retailers are playing now is to be able to take a look at that whole universe of products out there and then be able to go to a grower and say, all right, we think in your soil type, in your moisture conditions, your cropping rotation, your climate, et cetera, this is a package of products that, that can deliver some results on your farm. Farmers just don't have time to evaluate all of them. And so they rely on trusted advisors to do it. And that's a critical role that I think ag retailers are going to play for the next several years.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
What is the goal of the 30-30? And is the goal actually accomplished by producer? Is the goal actually going to hit the ground? Is the goal actually something that is ultimately going to affect producers?
2 years ago, Congress was focused on the 30 by 30 plan. Kimberly Ratcliffe is ranch manager of Caney Creek Ranch in Texas.
Because a lot of times these programs are implemented without even coming down to people who are producers and asking our input in them. So we have to have a seat at the table when it comes to things, when it comes to programs that are initially coming out, so we can put our input in and allow us to be profitable and allow us to have some kind of success story when it comes out. So I don't know if the 30 by 30 will actually provide that.
Ratcliffe explained to legislators how she ended up back at the ranch.
After leaving a New York City financial information firm in 2007, I returned to Caney Creek Ranch, my family operation in Oakwood, a small town in central East Texas. Our family-owned ranch was established in 2002 by my parents, Wesley and Marie Ratcliffe. I managed a daily operation where we produce Charvet cattle, which bulls, replacement heifers, semen, embryos are sold across the world. Working with my father and brother, I am leading our family business into the future, developing new line of businesses, using best practices on the ranch to increase resilience and efficiency, and strongly contributing to the success of our entire community. I am one of the founders of the 100 Ranchers, a community-based organization supporting minority producers across the country. It has introduced me to a number of producers who have shared their personal stories about their journey into agriculture, and many important conservation lessons I have learned. A friend of mine, a third-generation rancher from North Carolina, shared with me the importance of keeping forests as forests and passing on the responsibility to future generations. A friend of mine, a third-generation family, started in 1916 where his grandfather purchased 38 acres for $864. As he described, this was a great feat for a man, but particularly for an African-American. Initially, the focus was to clear the land. But as the old saying goes, money does not grow on trees. But today the story is different. Organizations like Sustainable Forestry for African American Land Retention Projects, where I serve on the Prairie View A&M local chapter board, are working with small landowners to introduce them to sustainable forestry as a tool to increase family income and land value. This includes Silver Pasture, a management system that integrates trees with forage and livestock production. Silver Pasture system optimizes three components: forage, livestock, and ecosystem. Trees are planted into rows or clusters, or forests are thinned to provide significant light for forage. On our family operation, we incorporate existing forage area to provide shade, timber, food for our livestock. The carbon captured in the soil and the trees more than makes up for the greenhouse gases that ruminants emit through belch and gas. The silver pasture system increases our productions of meat and milk, in part because the shade of the trees reduces stress on the livestock. The trees also provide a haven for wildlife habitat. The additional trees has brought about an increase in number of quail, deer, turkey that inhabit our farm. The trees also act as a buffer, preventing harmful nutrients from entering a nearby water source. We also practice rotational grazing, allowing our pastures to rest and recover and soil health to improve. We were introduced to many conservation plans, including rotational grazing, when we started working with USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. We learned how to improve efficiency of our pasture, about cross-fencing, as well as about programs after working with NRCS to develop a conservation plan.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Given how short we were the last marketing year and our big major rush that we'd had to secure any supplies that we could in fall of 2022, do we have enough corn? Do we have enough grain sorghum to actually get ourselves to the finish line of the next crop? And we really aren't trusting that wheat will be there. Again, we've had such damage in that. So wheat feeding option really probably isn't there this year.
Kansas State grain marketing economist Dan O'Brien.
So I guess it'd be an interesting last month or so, several months before we harvest next year's crop. And if anything, the grain sorghum basis levels are holding as strong, at least as steady, if not more so, than the corn basis numbers are. And it probably just, people can feed sorghum. There's no problem with that. Of course, there's a little bit of difference in blending of the diets. But, and again, as we'd mentioned, we have seen a little bit better sorghum export business of late, and that probably helps that crop.